Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The persistently controversial and lately intensifyingly maligned First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States is the most fundamental of the Bill of Rights because it protects all the others as well as the rest of the constitutional amendments. Above all, the First Amendment states clearly and simply that government has no right to interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings, or the right of the people to petition government for a redress of grievances, quote, unquote. But the First Amendment is once again under vigorous and vehement assault by President Donald Trump and his despotic and dystopian administration. Dissent, the most definitive and precarious form of free expression, is especially criticized in the current fetid atmosphere of bellicose Trumpism and is inferred to be treasonous. Yet now, when even perplexed friends and neighbors equivocally rebuke free speech as an enemy of the state, quote unquote, it is essential to resist eviscerating the First Amendment and suppressing democratic civil liberties. A useful public template for First Amendment free expression prominently exists in Charlottesville, Virginia, which became infamously notorious 2 years ago when homegrown American neo-Nazis clashed with anti-fascist protesters. One woman was killed when a Nazi sympathizer rammed his car into a crowd protesting the Nazi rally, which injured many others. But in 2000, the Charlottesville City Council voted to erect a 7-foot-high, 50-feet-long chalkboard at the City Hall on which anyone could write with chalk anything they wished to write, which surprised even its advocates. Newspaper columnist Ellen Goodwin wrote of the project at the time, "These days, we tend to think of free speech as one of those troublesome legacies of the Constitution that we have to tolerate, but not always enthusiastically." But, she wrote, free speech is not something chiseled in marble to be admired from afar. It is a messy and temporary and as powerful as the debate over this small space in the city of Charlottesville. Indeed, there was debate. People in Charlottesville feared swear words, swastikas, graffiti, and hate speech. Questions were asked about what should be read by children, a debate that obviously mirrored free speech itself. As one of the chalkboard's advocates said, "We envision the occasional racial slur, but we see 20 people responding as well." Another debate was, ironically, about the sole use of erasable chalk itself. The chalkboard was likened as a return to the sort of public discourse that was common in town squares of the 18th and 19th centuries before, as one person noted, newspaper publishers and radio and television producers began deciding what was publicly important. The project was sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, which is located at a farm at Charlottesville, once owned by Jefferson, now a property of the University of Virginia. Perhaps the idea of a public chalkboard might be more symbolic than consequential, and it seemed somewhat abnormal that the notion of a public space for people to express their thoughts and perhaps also opinions should be as provocative as was apparently argued at the start. It has acted more as a community bulletin board than a public bathroom wall. Oregon's own state constitution has a provision even stronger than the free speech part of the First Amendment. Article 1, Section 8. No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of that right. And that's from the Oregon State Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. And now, along those same lines, we must protect the First Amendment by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. My questions are, does the First Amendment need a rewrite in the era of Donald Trump? And should the rise of white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups prompt us to cut back the protections afforded to speech that expresses hatred and advocates violence? After the tragic violence at a white supremacist rally in Charlotte, Virginia on August 12, 2017, those questions took on renewed urgency. Those thorny free speech issues require me to first indulge in some personal history. For 12 years, 1968 to 1980, I lived in Normal, Illinois, where, among other assignments, I taught COM 304, Freedom of Speech and Press, at Illinois State University. My course focused on Supreme Court decisions relating to political dissent, obscenity, provocation, and demonstration, and press freedom. As a young professor and card-carrying member of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, I was understandably upset when two strangers, clad in brown suits and shiny shoes, visited my class in September 1970. I suspected they were FBI or other government agents assigned by the so-called Justice Department to monitor the activities of potential rabble-rousing ACLU members like me who, quote, advocated overthrow of the government, unquote. After two visits, they disappeared, but the chilling effect lingered. Richard Nixon's Machiavellian conduct during that time typified executive abuse of power, at times threatening the freedom of speech, press, and political association. I probably didn't make his enemies list, but like others, endured some fear and resentment. Bloomington, Normal, Illinois, that's the Twin Cities, you might say, was also the March 9, 1918 birthplace of George Lincoln Rockwell, founder of the American Nazi Party. Rockwell was the blatantly racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic who invented the slogan, White Power. For several years after his death in 1967, a tiny band of brown-shirted Nazis came to Bloomington every March 9th to memorialize his birthday. Probably adorning their garb on the outskirts of Bloomington, the pathetic group marched down the main drag, chanting Sieg Heil, giving the Nazi salute and shouting, blood and soil, the same slogan uttered at Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 12, 2017. Our polite but firm protest exposed those white supremacist ideas to the condemnation they deserved, and moral condemnation, not legal suppression, was our appropriate response to the Nazis' despicable ideas. Our most powerful response to the hated Nazi rhetoric was not suppression, but more speech. Incidentally, Bloomington, Illinois was the birthplace of the American Nazi Party founder and the birthplace of Illinois governor and twice presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson. More evidence that American communities can harbor truly conflicting ideologies. Fast forward to the 2016-2017 Donald J. Trump campaign and presidency. I think the future of the First Amendment is at issue. According to an earlier 2015 Pew Research Center poll, 40% of millennials think that the government should be able to suppress speech deemed offensive to minority groups, compared with only 12% of those born between 1928 and 1945. Young people today are voicing far less faith in free speech than did their grandparents. Those who oppose the protection of racist speech make several arguments, claiming that the history of mob and state violence targeting African Americans makes racist speech directed at them especially indefensible. Tolerating such speech, they argue, reinforces the harm Americans have done to African Americans, from slavery through Jim Crow to today's de facto segregation, implicit bias, and structural discrimination. And now that white supremacists have a friend in the White House, a different approach seems justified. or so some say. There is some truth in those propositions. America remains profoundly unequal, and our historical treatment of African Americans has been shameful. The scourge of racism persists to this day. Of course, racist speech causes real harm, inspiring violence and intimidating people from freely exercising their rights. There's no doubt that Donald Trump's appeals to white resentment and his reluctance to condemn white supremacists after Charlottesville on August 12, 2017, have emboldened many racists. But in the public arena, none of those unfortunate truths supports authorizing the state to suppress speech that advocates ideas anti-ethical to egalitarian values. If free speech is critical to democracy and to holding our representatives accountable, we cannot allow our representatives to suppress ideas they think are wrong, false, or disruptive. The state must be neutral with regard to speakers' viewpoints, though it's virtually impossible to articulate a standard for suppression of speech that would not allow government officials dangerously broad discretion and invite discrimination against particular viewpoints. Throughout history, disadvantaged minority groups have effectively used the First Amendment to speak, associate, and assemble for the purpose of demanding their rights. Where would the movements for racial justice, women's rights, and LGBTQ equality be without a muscular First Amendment? The response to Charlottesville showed the power of talking back. When Trump declared that there were fine people, quote-unquote, on both sides, he quickly found himself isolated. Prominent Republicans, military leaders, business executives, and conservative, moderate, and liberal commentators alike condemned the ideology of white supremacy and Trump himself. When white supremacists called a rally in Boston a week after Charlottesville, they mustered only a handful of supporters, vastly outnumbered by tens of thousands of counter-protesters who peacefully marched to condemn white supremacy, racism, and hatred. Boston proved yet again that the most powerful speech that we hate is not suppression, but more speech. The First Amendment protects speech, but not violence. Our history illustrates that, unless very narrowly constrained, the power to restrict the advocacy of violence is an invitation to punish political dissent. Historical figures like A. Mitchell Palmer, J. Edgar Hoover, and Joseph McCarthy all use the advocacy of violence as a justification to punish people associated with communists, socialists, or civil rights groups. Yet, in a 1969 ACLU case involving a Ku Klux Klan rally in Brandenburg versus Ohio, the Supreme Court ruled that speech advocating violence is protected unless it is likely to incite imminent lawless action. But aside from instances in which speech and violence are inextricably intertwined, speech advocating violence gets full First Amendment protection. Even though the First Amendment poses especially thorny problems of interpretation, free speech enables us to ultimately resolve our differences through public reason. Violence is its antithesis. The First Amendment protects the exchange of views, not the exchange of bullets. We protect the First Amendment not only because it is the lifeblood of democracy and an indispensable element of freedom, but because it is the guarantor of civil society itself. We must value and defend the First Amendment, which protects the press, religion, the academy, and political parties. In the era of Donald Trump, the importance of preserving these avenues of advocating justice and preserving democracy should be more evident than ever. And a footnote. On February 4th, 2019, an 11-year-old black sixth-grade boy was arrested in Lakeland, Florida, for refusing to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, claiming it was racist against black people. His teacher suggested that he, a black 11-year-old, should move back to Cuba and sent him to the principal's office, where he was detained and subsequently arrested. the Lawton Childs Middle Academy was not held accountable. Students were allowed to opt out of recitation of the pledge, but only with written authorization from a parent. Sadly, First Amendment rights sometimes seem secondary, especially for innocent middle school kids. And that was We Must Protect the First Amendment by Dr. Robert Brake, who is a former college professor and lives in Ocean Park, Washington. He is a frequent contributor to the Chinook Observer and to this program. And now, A Conservative Betrayed by Leslie Miller. I was raised in a very conservative family. The values I was taught are a far cry from what is being practiced by the Republican Party today. They are not in observance of traditional philosophy, but appear to be extreme in their ideology. The difference between a philosopher and an ideologue is that a philosopher may believe in conservatism, but is willing to listen to divergent thoughts and change his or her mind if an argument answers an apparent need. An ideologue operates from a fixed viewpoint, and all the answers are listed in a predetermined book. If the problem is not in that book, it simply does not exist. There is no argument and no dialogue. If you bring up something outside of the accepted party line, you are stereotyped and belittled. You are either with us or against us. The Founding Fathers were deists, not Christian fundamentalists. They believed in a higher power, but that each person has the right to choose what that higher power is. The Establishment Clause in the Constitution prohibits the creation of a state religion. Church and state are to be kept separate in order to guarantee this most personal of freedoms. Benjamin Franklin said that a people who are willing to sacrifice liberty for the sake of security deserve neither. George Washington warned against the establishment of a large standing army and to beware of foreign entanglements. Dwight D. Eisenhower, more recently, warned about an emerging military-industrial congressional complex. I add the word congressional, as it was part of the president's original draft of his farewell address. These are all traditional conservative thoughts. These statements apply to today's world just as well. True conservatives believe that government is like a council fire where all views are listened to. This demands dialogue. Each person has the right and obligation to express opinion and dissent about government programs and policies, especially when lives are at risk. The loyal opposition's viewpoint is to be listened to and respected in order to make informed decisions and to avoid alienation of the minority. Small government is better than a large bureaucratic establishment. Each person has the right to vote and is to be treated equally under the law. These rights are not to be diminished. A person may not be arrested, nor may his or her property or vehicle be searched or seized without a warrant sworn before an impartial judge. We have the right to do anything we wish in the privacy of our own homes, as long as we cause no harm to others. The Constitution was created for the benefit of all human beings, and these rights do not necessarily accrue only to U.S. citizens. All people aspire to these values, however little they may be practiced by foreign governments. To the extent that government exists, it is for the protection of the individual rights of all. Diplomacy and trade are less expensive and more productive and practical than fighting, regardless of how much patience and time it takes to obtain an agreement or treaty. It is not our policy to attack first, but if someone starts a war with us, we are likely to finish it. Only Congress has the power to declare and fund war, as in the First and Second World Wars, the last legal wars that were formally declared rather than made by congressional resolution. The president is extremely limited in using military force, except for sending rescue missions of short duration to save people's lives at sea or abroad. The Constitution may be amended only by a two-thirds majority of Congress. The judicial, legislative, and executive branches of government were created in order to balance the application of power. The constitutional framework is intended to keep each branch in check. The founders wanted to keep tyranny from taking control in any one of these divisions. Their world was full of dictators with their own armies, empires, state churches, and whose every whim was law. They wished for our country to avoid that fate. The 14th and 15th Amendments were to guarantee that each person has a vote that counts just as much as any other, and that all people are equal under the law. The rights of the individual exceed those of institutions, such as the state, church, corporation, or any other bureaucracy. Local government exceeds the state, and the state exceeds the federal in authority. At the risk of repetition, to the extent that government exists, its primary reason is to preserve individual rights above everything else. A balanced budget is one of the ultimate goals of conservatism. Both military and social programs are to be equally limited. This thriftiness is not supposed to be limited to the bottom line, but always saving resources for the future. If a natural resource is totally exhausted, it is no longer of benefit to anyone. These ideologues who call themselves conservatives seem unwilling to conserve anything, including the national treasury. I applauded Ronald Reagan's promise to strip down government, but now these false Republicans have inflicted the greatest deficit in U.S. history, not at all conservative. We are signatory to the Geneva Conventions, and we should treat prisoners accordingly, whether they signed on to the program or not. The issue is about what we are as Americans, not about how inhumane our enemies are. If we torture or treat our prisoners harshly, we are no better than they are. The Japanese military during the Second World War were not signatory to the conventions, and they treated our soldiers in a barbaric and despicable manner. However, we treated them with kindness once they were captured. That made all the difference between us, and it is something to be proud of as Americans. It is a practical consideration as well. A person being tortured will tell his captor anything he wants to hear just to get the pain to stop. This makes for poor intelligence, which cannot be applied to the war, so torture cannot be rationalized to obtain information. Interrogators who spoke to Japanese prisoners in their language understood their culture, were generous and kind to them, and received quality intelligence that was accurate and applicable. The Geneva Conventions are not so complicated as to make it hard to get information. If one of the goals of conservatism is to get big government off the little person's back, then it has failed miserably. The military and law enforcement agencies have become bloated while social programs have been cut remorselessly. Our government has become bigger and worse. I love my country, but my government scares me. The founders debated long and hard about a standing army because its existence tempts politicians and generals to start an empire and perform a military coup d'etat. Presently, the threat of terrorism being used to corrupt the Constitution. We are exhorted to sacrifice our privacy for the sake of security. These are the domestic enemies our founders warned us about. These neoconservatives contend we are a Christian nation, implying that there is no difference between public policies and their fundamentalist dogma. The war on terrorism is a good example. It might as well be called a war on dandruff, for all the term describes. In the lexicon, terrorist is a buzzword for an extreme Muslim fundamentalist who is willing to commit suicide with a bomb and murder innocent victims simultaneously. It follows that since the bomber has no respect for human life, he has no rights as a human being. Therefore, he should be hunted down and killed like a mad dog. We carpet bomb and launch smart bombs, which can kill indiscriminately. So in a sense, we are no better than they are. It seems that our extremists are feeding their extremists by the same rationale. People of more moderate thought inside the three faiths outnumber the extremists within the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic traditions. A handful of hardliners within each seem to drive and control the rest. The demagogues in each group seem to be why the Middle East is such a source of heartbreak and violence to the whole world. It appears they are bound to take the rest of us into the apocalypse against all odds. Rather than a council fire, government has become a pyre to burn anyone who dissents. As conservative as I have been stereotyped and dismissed as a liberal simply because I disagree. Dialogue is not desired. There can be no loyal opposition. There is only one way to do things, and if the answer isn't in the party dogma, there is nothing else. Decisions are made without listening to facts and divergent opinions. Poor decisions are the practicable outcome. People are now being arrested and taken to jail without a warrant, vehicles searched and impounded, depending upon an officer's suspicions. The police and prison systems have grown to monstrous proportions. There is no control of defense spending. This is big, bad government at its worst. After fighting the totalitarian state of Russia for over 50 years, it seems our government has become more like that of our Cold War foe. Our courts depend on the appointment of impartial judges. Presidents appoint ideologues. One person's vote does not count the same as another's when a recount is stopped, and when we use touchscreen voting machines that do not provide a paper trail or can be corrupted with a computer program to fix an election. How about weapons contractors that do not have to bid for contracts, have no field tests of weapons systems, have no limit on spending, and have no quota or deadline? During World War II, politicians and contractors that bilked the taxpayer like this were heavily fined and sent to prison. Terrorism is claimed to be a new kind of war with a new kind of enemy, which justifies extremism in the application of extraordinary force in policies both here and abroad. That is a fallacy. We have fought the Barbary pirates with their kidnapping, forced slavery, ransom, and murder. We fought the Japanese and won, in spite of their suicidal tactics and inhumane acts. To commit murder, suicide, a person has to be convinced that the world is such a horrible place, that life isn't worth living, and brainwashed into thinking violence will improve it. This war is not just a war of military action, but a war of ideas. Nothing is being said and done to win the hearts or minds of the Muslim world. Why would it benefit Iran to embrace more moderate thinking? We can destroy the Taliban's weapons and we can kill their bodies, but we can't destroy an idea. Unless we come up with better ideas, we are bound to lose. We are losing now. We might run out of corpses before they do. As the emerging nations develop, albeit crude, versions of our weapons of mass destruction, I fear that the next genocide will include our species. After Vietnam, the politicians promised we would never send our forces into combat without a plan to get in, achieve the objective, and get out. Never again would we get bogged down in the quagmire for years or decades. My hopes for the future consist of two wishes. Everyone agrees that something is broken. I wish for a candidate, whether Republican, Democrat, or Independent, who can describe what is wrong and offer a plan to fix it. I am tired of voting for the lesser of two evils, or, as LaDonna Harris, vice presidential candidate for the People's Party in 1976, called it, the evil of two lessers. Unfortunately, it takes huge amounts of corporate contributions to run for office. The corporations contribute to both parties. Whoever is elected owes more to the special interests than to their voting constituents. Big businesses make their profits because the political system is compromised. I suspect the necessary reforms are unlikely in the near future. Nonetheless, the power of the corporations and their paid lobbyists must be curtailed, or our republic will remain at risk. I hope that honest conservatives might revolt against the neos and reform the Republican Party from within. Until then, I will remain a conservative betrayed. Lee Miller was a frequent contributor to the North Coast Times-Eagle. And this is an excerpt of an article that was published in an October 2006 issue when an earlier unelected Republican pretender kidnapped the White House. This is Michael McCusker. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee today, 51 years ago, on April 4, 1968. Unlike Donald Trump, who has deliberately and underhandedly schemed for a Nobel Peace Prize, MLK was the recipient of the Nobel for his principled and profoundly articulate leadership in the war against racism and poverty. He was in Memphis supporting a garbage and trash collection workers' strike.